You are listening to Relatos Zapatistas, transmitting Zapatismo desde el otro lado on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM. And up next, we're going to interview Molly from Critical Resistance and Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Group. First, we're going to listen to a small clip from StopMax.org that kind of brings sounds from what are called the SHU, or the Solitary Housing Units. So we're going to play that and then come back with the interview.
The hole, the bucket, the can,
the box, the hole, the bing,
the chiller,
lockup,
maxi,
the shoe,
solitary confinement,
the cell was probably like maybe 7 feet, maybe 9 feet long,
maybe 9 by 6.
It's very small.
The cell was a windowless cell.
The walls were cinder block.
The floor, it was concrete.
The bed is concrete. There's a small concrete slab that serves as your table.
You had nothing in the room but you.
It's hard to describe nothing.
Just your lonely body in a cell that's empty. That's what solitary confinement is.
Metal and cement.
That was it.
The light.
There's lights on most of the night.
Double neon light.
The light would be on sometime 24/7. It never went out. The situation I was in, they never turned the lights on. The lights were out 24 hours a day.
Numbers released by the Federal Receiver's Office show that on September 28th, nearly 12,000 prisoners were on hunger strike, including California prisoners who are housed in out-of-state prisons in Arizona, Mississippi, and Oklahoma. This historic and unprecedented number shows the strength and resolve of the prisoners to win their 5 core demands and is a serious challenge to the power of the California prison system and to the prison industrial complex in general. Prisoners are currently on strike in the Pelican Bay State Prison, Calipatria, Centinela, Corcoran, Iron State Prison, Kern Valley State Prison, North Kern State Prison, and Salinas Valley State Prison. Throughout the last week, prisoners at California Rehabilitation Center for Norco, Pleasant Valley State Prison, San Quentin, as well as West Valley Detention Center in San Bernardino County were participating. The receiver's office and the CDCR begin monitoring prisoners who have refused food for 72 hours or for 9 consecutive meals. Representatives of the hunger strikers have previously stated that this will be a rolling strike, allowing prisoners to come off strike to regain strength. Because of this, numbers will likely fluctuate throughout the duration of the strike. With us in the studio, we have Molly from Critical Resistance, and who has been organizing around not only the current hunger strike, but the one that happened on started on July 1st. And lasted over 20 days. And can you explain the conditions and struggles that resulted in the hunger strike that happened earlier this summer? So the July 1st one, like what led up to that one?
So the first round of the hunger strike that started on July 1st is about the same thing that it is now, which is to protest the torturous conditions and practices of the CDCR, specifically in the security housing units, or the SHUs, and administrative segregation, which is referred to as ADSEG or ASUs. The conditions of these units, these solitary confinement units, are absolutely atrocious. They're the worst prison conditions that the U.S. prison systems have to offer. They range between 7 by 10 foot cells and 6 by 9 foot cells of poured concrete with no windows, a fluorescent light that's beaming all the time, and prisoners are kept in there for at least 23 hours per day. But also, these maximum security prisons are often on lockdown for very arbitrary reasons. So, you know, for instance, last year, Pelican Bay was on lockdown for like 9 months. So that's 9 months of never being let out of what's essentially a concrete bathroom. You're in there alone. You know, the guards provide the food for you, and so a lot of the time the food is tampered with. Prisoners have reported that, you know, guards have poured bleach in their food, that they pee in their food, they do all kinds of terrible things. So those are kind of some of the conditions that the that the hunger strikers are protesting. The practices of the CDCR are also torture, right? They're torture by international human rights standards. What the CDCR does, how you get placed in the SHU, it's an administrative move, right? So the guards decide who gets placed in the SHU for what reasons and for how long. So the majority of the people who are placed in SHUs or in solitary confinement have indefinite terms, which means that there isn't, you know, any sort of explanation as to how long they're going to be placed in these units. The only way to get out of these units is to debrief, which is basically to snitch. So it means that you have to offer up information of other prisoners being involved in different gangs or in different groups in prison in order to be let out, right? So if someone is being treated badly or being put in brutal conditions, and the only way for that practice to stop is to offer up information, that is torture. It really just is that basic.
It endangers the families on the outside as well, right?
Correct. So, I mean, it's not, you know, it extends the impact of prison beyond just the people who are in these cells, right? Because their families are essentially doing this kind of time too. You know, it's not a coincidence that SHUs were designed directly after the 1960s and the 1970s, when the state was responding to quell radical and revolutionary organizing in communities of color in the U.S. And also while, you know, all these uprisings were happening against racism and economic inequality and other forms of oppression, that was also a very ripe time for anti-imperialist organizing, right? So a large majority of the prisoners who are currently in the SHU and have been in the SHU for 30 and 40 years, so we're not talking about being locked in a bathroom for a day, we're talking about decades, right? Decades of very severe social and physical deprivation. The majority of these prisoners are political prisoners, right? So Hugo Pinnell, who was a member of the San Quentin Six and organized with George Jackson in the 1960s at San Quentin, has been locked up in solitary confinement for nearly 40 years. He's been at Pelican Bay in the SHU since Pelican Bay opened in 1989. You know, a majority of the prisoners are in the SHUs are also jailhouse lawyers. You know, so these units are used to break up the connections and the relationships that prisoners are making with each other, and also to stop the ways that they challenge the prison system as a whole.
And so there were five demands during that strike, and the government responded kind of falsely. Can you talk about the response from the state, both the like official response that they told the media, but then also maybe some of the backlash that the prisoners felt after that strike and after negotiations were over?
Absolutely. So the five, just real quick, I just want to mention the five core demands so that people are familiar with them. The first demand is to end administrative abuse. The second is to abolish the debriefing policy and to modify active-inactive gang status criteria, right? So just as gangs are being criminalized outside of prison for a very large range of reasons, from like wearing certain colors to certain tattoos to different forms of association and affiliation, that kind of stuff. Those very arbitrary criteria are exacerbated inside of prison, right? So they're trying to change what that criteria is. The third demand is to comply with the 2006 U.S. Commission on safety and abuse in America's prisons, which said that there needed to be an end to indefinite solitary confinement. So that was something that was already passed, and the CDCR is in violation of that, so the prisoners are saying they need to comply with it. The fourth demand is to provide adequate and nutritious food, and the fifth demand is to expand programs and privileges for SHU status prisoners. They want things like art supplies. They want, you know, a phone call. They don't get phone calls to their families. You know, they want proctored exams for the courses that they need to take, you know, like very, very basic privileges. And all of the prisoners, so as the strike has spread to different prisons throughout the state, And those numbers have fluctuated. It's not just hunger strikers at Pelican Bay. And all of these demands include SHU status prisoners throughout the state. However, the fifth demand of the privileges, that depends on prison to prison because they provide different programs and privileges at different facilities. So that's the only thing that changes. And we see that difference between specifically hunger strikers at Calipatria down south versus hunger strikers at Pelican Bay. So in terms of some of the responses from the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, before the strike started on July 1st, we immediately saw retaliation. Before the strike started, for instance, they released a quote-unquote 4th of July menu, which featured food that has never been served to SHU prisoners or prisoners in general ever, like ice cream, cake, that kind of stuff, to try to dissuade people from joining the strike even before it started. Right away when the strike started, the CDCR was withholding very necessary information about prisoners' medical situations. They weren't following protocol that is set forth by the federal receivership that, you know, the CDCR has to follow in regards to strikes. For instance, the second that prisoners start to refuse state-issued food, they need to be weighed and their health needs to start to be monitored. And the CDCR didn't do that for several days into the strike. The CDCR was also putting weights on prisoners, or they weren't taking prisoners' shackles off when they were being weighed to tamper with some of that information. They also just straight up lied about how big the strike was. You know, they said it was only a couple of dozen prisoners at Pelican Bay, and it was actually more than 6,600 prisoners statewide. They did that again where they just, the second round of the strike, they said that only 3,000 prisoners are resuming the strike, and we actually just found out that it was nearly 12,000 prisoners. You know, so the crux of this issue is how the state controls basic communication and information with our loved ones behind these walls. A lot of other retaliation has gotten much more severe. They've been issuing 128 write-ups, which are basically slips that go into people's permanent records. And what it leads to is denied parole. If you ever come up to the parole board, you can lose your in-prison job. It's basically a mark on your record that you participated in what has been deemed a prison disruption, which is actually this, you know, time-old strategy of nonviolent, peaceful civil disobedience, right? They're calling it a disruption. They've also banned two of our lawyers from being in communication with hunger strikers. So we're currently trying to fight that because a main way that we've been able to support prisoners in continuing the strike and to also publicize it is through the legal visits and the communication that we've had legally with the hunger strikers, specifically at Pelican Bay and Corcoran. You know, so the retaliation has been a range. I think like one thing to really point out that we don't often see as retaliation, but it definitely is how the CDCR has been justifying its practices and conditions by saying that all of the hunger strikers are vicious, quote unquote, gang members, right? So that's a direct insistence that they're using so that they can justify the torture that they use, right? Because the second that, I mean, we see that in the fight against gang injunctions, right? The second that fear mongering, the second someone says gang, everyone's like, oh yeah, well, I guess they deserve it. You know, so I think that definitely is a form of retaliation, right? Because it's continuing to dehumanize people who are not being recognized as human beings in the first place.
And so the second strike came because none of the demands were met the first time. Have the demands changed? And you already mentioned a little bit how the organizing between people inside and outside has been impacted. And if you wanted to add anything about on the organizing efforts and how they've had to change for the second strike.
So the demands have not been met. The demands stay the same. You know, the addition is that we've been in more consistent communication now with prisoners at Calipatria. And so their fifth demand is a little different, right? They want, like, specific kinds of art supplies. You know, they don't have, the main thing is that they don't have PIA soft shoes and radios or TVs, and prisoners at Pelican Bay do. So, you know, like, there's just kind of those little differences. But, I mean, I think the main thing for people outside of prison to understand is, like, you know, these little concessions or the little privileges seem very little to us outside, right? But when you're locked in a concrete bathroom for decades at a time, being able to tell time and to have a calendar is a huge deal, right? Like, to actually be able to keep track of how much time is going by is really, really big. You know, so I think that has been one of the challenges, just in terms of trying to grow and build support for this strike outside, because after the strike was called off, or suspended, I should say, because it's a continuation, it's not a different strike. Once the strike was suspended, you know, the support outside hasn't been the same that it was in July. And I think part of that is, I mean, I don't know what all of that's about, but I think that part of it is people just not really understanding kind of the weight of it and the stakes, and just like how isolated we get, how isolated we are from even understanding like the weight of what the hunger strikers are going through. And I mean, I do want to mention though that at the center of the organizing outside have been people's loved ones and family members, and also former prisoners. You know, so I think in terms of the strategies that we're using, we're not only trying to publicize that this strike is happening and to amplify the voices of prisoners who have been writing really amazing political statements. If people want to read them, they should definitely check out our website. It's prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com. There's a page on there called Voices from Inside, and it's all the letters and the political statements that we're getting from the hunger strikers at multiple prisons. But I mean, the other strategy that we're primarily trying to use is to pressure state representatives to get involved, right? Because the CDCR has to respond to the governor. And now, especially that our lawyers have been banned from communication, it's a matter of trying to build that pressure on representatives to investigate what is going on and to make the CDCR make these changes faster. Because what the prisoners are asking for are actually really basic things that they can change. It's just the only reason why they're not doing that is for precedent. You know, they say that they do not negotiate with prisoners, kind of like the quote unquote, we don't negotiate with terrorists line, right? It's like, that's to the extent that they're not recognizing people's humanity. And you know, so family members have really been pushing for regular mobilizations and convergences in Sacramento, and there's going to be another one on October 5th. So there's information about that on our website that people should check out if they want to support it.
Okay. And are there any local events that are going to be happening maybe after Sacramento or before Sacramento?
Right. So we have regular vigils that are happening, and we just wanted to create a space for community gathering, and also to try to make some links between local struggles of organizing in the Bay Area. So there's a rotating vigil that's happening on Thursdays while the strike is continuing. The exact details again are on the website, but we're rotating between Oakland and San Francisco. So our last one was in downtown Oakland, and our next one will be in San Francisco, and then the week after we'll come back to Oakland.
Great. And so there's strategies that are directly related to the strike and bringing attention to it and making sure the CDCR is being held accountable for all the illegal things that this law or they represent the government in a certain way, but they're breaking the laws of the state at the same time. So there's those strategies that you've talked about, but then there's also strategies on the ground, and I think it's related to what our last guest was saying, and Kamau's still here, so if you want to talk about it, what strategies is the prisoner hunger strike solidarity group also sort of supporting that has to do with keeping people who are systematically placed in prison out of prison? So maybe something that wasn't mentioned before.
I mean, I think to recap, a big emphasis is to try to integrate amplifying what's happening inside of prison, right, and exposing that while also combating the policing that's happening in our communities, right? Because policing doesn't just take our loved ones away from our communities and into prison, but it also extends prisons beyond prison walls. Like, we see that in West Oakland all the time, right? Cole Middle School was just turned into a cop shop, right? So, like, you actually are changing landscapes and spaces so that the exact same communities that are being systematically locked up are essentially experiencing a locked up life outside of prison. You know, and that's specifically seen through gang injunctions, curfews, loitering ordinances, you know, different procedural issues with parole, all the different ways that we're being surveilled, everything. But with that, we have to be amplifying all of the ways that our communities are also constantly creating alternatives or creating ways of addressing harm and violence without policing and imprisonment, right? And I think one thing that we've been trying to focus on is organizing with family members who haven't necessarily been doing political work before. You know, a lot of families also have family members who are guards, also have family members who are police officers. And that's because, again, specifically in California, we see the political economy of California rely so heavily on the prison system, right? So the same communities that are being targeted are also communities that are being forced to rely on the systems that are oppressing them. So I think, like, one project that Critical Resistance also works on is called STOP, the Storytelling and Organizing Project. You can find us at stopviolenceeveryday.org, and we collect stories of how people have intervened in harm and violence in their lives without involving child protective services, the police, or prisons. And, you know, so I think it's a matter of just highlighting the strategies that we're already using, even though we may not recognize them as strategies, right? Also, there's a big opportunity right now because, like I mentioned a little bit before, California's prison system is under federal receivership because the California's prison system was found to be in violation of the Eighth Amendment by the U.S. Supreme Court. So California was ordered to release more than 30,000 prisoners. And the way that they're doing that is they're calling it realignment, where they're basically shifting a number of people in state prisons to county jails. So, you know, this is both a threat and an opportunity, right? It's just up to us organizing on the ground to make it more of an opportunity than a threat. You know, it's not a coincidence that this round of the strike, the second round of the strike, of those 12,000 prisoners who joined in solidarity were included prisoners at two county jails in San Bernardino County, right? Because the conditions that are so atrocious aren't just, again, in the shoes, but they're across the board throughout the system. You know, so I think, you know, the same communities that are fighting against gang injunctions are also the same communities who know all of the challenges and obstacles that come with their loved ones being shifted around in the prison system all the time, from shoes to general population to jails and stuff like that. So I think our responses, our grassroots responses to realignment, we're still working that out, but that's something that's kind of just presenting itself right now. And I think the challenge for us as organizers on a grassroots level is to try to amplify all of these different fights, not just as one, so that we lose all the different nuances, because they're not just the exact same thing, but, you know, just like really recognizing how they play off of each other, you know, so that when we make one gain in one area, we can amplify that to make that a victory and a gain in another.
Thank you, Molly. Thank you for being on the show. And so the best place to get information would be at prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com. And we encourage everyone to get involved. And there's also a lot of information on the Critical Resistance website, criticalresistance.org. Yep. And then there's Stop the Gang Injunctions.
stoptheinjunctions.wordpress.com.
All right. And thank you to both of you for sharing the work that's happening in the East Bay.